keeping democracy alive with Bert Cohen.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shootings, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Is it a dream for the entire world to either just treat us with respect and not attack us? Or is it a dream that many people feel that we, the United States, has to dominate the world, that that's the right way it should be, that we that there's some manifest destiny that the U.S. should rule the world? How has that served us so well for the past 100 years or so? What else can be done? Well, one of our presidents who, really is clearly one of the greatest presidents the United States was ever blessed to have was Franklin Roosevelt. And we all know about his taking on the Depression with the New Deal, his ramping up the military to defeat the Nazis and the Japanese in the Second World War. But his general overall look at what American policy should be toward other nations is perhaps a little bit less known. Well, I'm very pleased that my guest today on the Bert Cohen Show is David Woolner from, well, he's a senior fellow at and Hyde Park resident historian for the Roosevelt Institute. David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Bert. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, David Woolner is currently writing a book entitled Cordell Hull, Anthony Eden, and the Search for Anglo-American Cooperation, 1933 through 1938. A heck of a time that was when England was justifiably quite afraid of Nazi aggression, and a lot of work needed to be done, and luckily Franklin Roosevelt was there to help save England from the Nazis. Well, here we are, and there's a lot of discussion about what American policy should be. But there's been some attacks in the Middle East, and it's the anger at the United States is coming to a boil in many places. Obama believes we can, quote, get a Middle East and North Africa that is more peaceful, more prosperous, and more aligned with our interests. Romney said, for his part, the aim of a large share of our aid must be the promotion of work and the fostering of free enterprise. He said, nothing we can do as a nation will change lives and nations more effectively and permanently than sharing the insight that lies at the foundation of America's own economy, and that is that free people pursuing happiness in their own ways build a strong and prosperous nation. Well, David, what do you think of the comparisons? Well, we just need to show them that free enterprise, that the imposition of free enterprise is really what's best for them.
Well, it's interesting. Again, much like the domestic situation, we see a lot of parallels between what was going on in the 1930s and 40s between Franklin Roosevelt and his conservative opponents. And it's interesting. You know, back in Roosevelt's day, in the early 40s, Henry Luce, the publisher of Time and other major American publications, wrote a very important article talking about the launch of the American century. And in part, he was talking about a greater degree of American intervention in the world. But the article also had a kind of overtone that the United States really needed to school the rest of the world and knew best, and we needed to promote our values and so forth. Things that in many ways were not controversial, but on the other hand, it did take on this kind of we know best sort of approach. And even back then, there were opponents or critics who were uncomfortable with the way Henry Luce had characterized America's role in the world. And of course, part of what he was trying to do was just simply do that, to promote the idea that the United States needed to be engaged, and certainly President Roosevelt and some of his senior advisors would agree with that. But, for example, Henry Wallace, who was at the time vice mm-hmm. president, kind of responded to Henry Luce by saying, we don't need an American century, we need the century of the common man. And he talked about the fact that we had been suffering poverty for millennia and injustice for millennia, and that in order to really create a truly peaceful world, you had to attack the root of those kinds of problems, the economic depravity, the economic dislocation of the world, dividing up the world into colonial spheres. And it was a much more bottom-up approach than what Luce had articulated. Luce's idea, essentially, that as long as we provide American values and political principles, the world will take care of itself.
Right, and we've seen how well that worked. I find it fascinating about, as somebody said, I don't know the source of this quote, but the only thing we learn from history is that we never learn from history. And in an address to the American Legion and in many other statements he's made about foreign policy, Mitt Romney has called for the establishment of what he calls, quote, an American century, unquote, as if he's made this up. And he elaborates, without American leadership, without clarity of American purpose and resolve, the world becomes a far more dangerous place, and liberty and prosperity would surely be among the first casualties. Now, I wonder if, with your historical knowledge, if you could comment.
Well, it's interesting. Again, from the Rooseveltian perspective, from the perspective of the generation that fought the Second World War, there was no question that the war itself had economic causes. And it was the poverty, it was the desperation of people that led them to embrace extreme ideologies like Nazism and like totalitarianism and communism uh-huh. and so forth. And so from a very early point, even almost before the war got started in 1939, the Roosevelt administration committed itself to the idea that you really had to attack these fundamental problems. And it was best articulated, in addition to the Wallace speech that I just mentioned, in Roosevelt's famous Four Freedoms Address of January 1941, where he said, we need to do more to help the British in their war effort. We hadn't entered the war yet, but
right.
He was posing the question, why do we need to make this sacrifice for the American people? And he basically said, because we want to establish a world when this is all over where that is based on four fundamental human freedoms, freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. And this was a very fundamental component of Roosevelt's philosophy. You know, not only in the international sphere, but also in the domestic sphere, he was consistently made the argument that the founding fathers had gotten it right when it came to personal liberty, when it came to ideas like freedom of worship and freedom of speech. But, you know, the world that we lived in the 20th century, now the 21st century, was much different. And we needed to think about the economic dimension and the idea of, actually, he eventually articulated, of an economic bill of rights.
Mm-hmm.
That people needed to have access to a good job and health care and even leisure, that these were fundamental rights and that needed to be addressed in a 20th century complex economy. And so for him and for many of his generation, global poverty was the cause of the worst catastrophe humankind had ever known, the Second World War, with all of its brutality. And so they really tried to commit themselves to pursuing policies that would, as I say, lift people up from the bottom up. And that philosophy, by the way, resonated right around the world. And Roosevelt became, and the United States became, the champion of the poor and the champion of the people around the world who were yearning not only for freedom, but for that basic economic security.
And that's certainly the world in which I grew up in the 1950s, where there was no question that people throughout the developing world did, in fact, look up to the United States for leadership. And it wasn't just because of our military strength and you know, total domination, which we had, but it was because of our ability to really live freedom and to enjoy freedom. And my sense as a kid was that this was something in basic to human nature, that you want to be able to enjoy life, as President Roosevelt was talking about there, as you were describing, freedom from want. And we are discussing your article here, David Wilner, about bringing freedom from want back to foreign policy. And I just think about so much history, my own personal history. I was working on the campaign of former Senator George McGovern in 1984, when, yes, he did run for president a second time, obviously didn't get the nomination. But in so many places, this was back, of course, Ronald Reagan was president, and we were fighting the evils of communism and Soviet expansionism at the time. And in every speech he gave, pretty much, he'd say, "We can do more to dry up the swamplands of despair that feed communism." Now you could say feed terrorism. "We can do more to dry up those swamplands of despair with our American educational help, our medical help, our agricultural help, than with all the military hardware in our huge arsenal." David, is this what you mean by a new policy focusing on addressing freedom from want? It sounds like it might be.
Absolutely. We have, unfortunately, in a way, as you said at the outset, refused to learn from the past. The American reaction to terrorism has been enormously militarized. Yes. We have, in the decision to call the war on terror a war, we in a sense militarized the conflict. And this is not to say that the terrorists aren't bad people, and it's not mm-hmm. to say that they're not criminals and murderers. But one philosophy or one approach to these kinds of problems is to say, no, I'm not going to elevate these thugs and murderers into the status of military people that we're fighting a war against. I'm going to call them what they are, which is criminals, and lead with a criminal justice system and treat it much like we treat the way we would treat international crime or international drug trafficking, that sort of thing. And really take a rule of law approach, and an approach that's based on those kinds of questions, rather than call it a war and lead with the military. That's not to say we wouldn't use the military in our efforts. It's not to say that we wouldn't use the intelligence services, et cetera. We would. But the emphasis on this idea that we are fighting a war on terror has, in many ways and in some respects, elevated the status of our opponents and provided them with a platform to say, you know, this United States is at war with Islam, it's at war with our way of thinking. And in a way, they have turned it around and used it as a recruiting tool. In addition, because we've been so focused on this military response, we have really neglected the other dimension, the soft power dimension of our foreign policy. Recent data now suggests that poverty and these kinds of problems, social problems, are a really integral part of the rise of extreme ideologies, including the religious fanaticism that's given rise to the terrorist movements in certain parts of the world. And yet, you know, we've done very little to try to counter that force. And again, the tendency that the great militarization of our policy, which really, to a certain extent, has continued in some ways and under different guises in the current administration, not served us as well as it should have. And we do need to think much more about how do we counter terrorism more on the ground, on the street level. How do we help these communities rid themselves of poverty and provide a kind of hopeful future, the kind of future that Franklin Roosevelt was talking about?
If you just tuned in, our guest today is David Wilner, senior fellow and Hyde Park resident historian at the Roosevelt Institute. We're talking about, we're discussing his article on bringing freedom from want back to foreign policy. Well, I wonder how much economic insecurity really is the root cause of terrorist attacks, or isn't it true that many, and at least in the Al-Qaeda leadership and other movements, are not suffering economically, that they're reasonably well off? I mean, Osama bin Laden was a fairly wealthy man. So can it be reduced to that, or isn't, you know, they talk about religiosity quite a bit and the struggle of Islam versus the West. So do you have insight into how much economic insecurity really is, maybe the root cause of terrorist attacks?
Well, you know, as these people need a constituency. And, you know, it's true that the leadership of Al-Qaeda and the leadership of many of these extremists come from fairly well-off and sometimes quite well-off backgrounds. But in order to be successful in their drive to, in a sense, counter our way of thinking and our values, they need a constituency. They need the support of their public. And we have done, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many other experts, not enough to counter the influence that they have gained in their own communities, because the people are frustrated, because they are suffering from poverty, because they see no hope for the future, and that they're turning to these more extreme ideologies or extreme forms of religion in order to try to search for a way out. One of the primary goals whenever you're dealing with an issue like terrorism is to try to isolate the terrorists and to isolate those terrorists from their constituency and to get them viewed essentially as criminals, not only by us but by their sure. home people. And you know, by declaring war and leading with the military, there's a tendency for that effort to be overshadowed by the rhetoric of war. And instead of seeing them as criminals, they suddenly become freedom fighters and war heroes and people who are standing up to this Goliath, standing up to this massive power of the United States. So I think, again, as I said, it's not to say that we don't have, the military doesn't have a role and that the intelligence services don't have a role. They certainly do. But we've paid so little attention to the other side of this equation.
And that other side being their how they can recruit people. And certainly I know that, back in Vietnam's struggle for independence from the French imperialists, Ho Chi Minh and others, they wanted, their people were hungry, they were impoverished. And they did, in fact, look to the United States based on what the United States looked like in the late 40s and early 50s, thinking that we would be on their side against colonialists. And when we didn't help them overcome poverty, and communists did, you know, nationalists did, what way are they going to turn? And I heard that a lot of the Vietnamese people really didn't, you know, care, communist, capitalist, whatever. They just wanted food and to have decent shelter. And as you mentioned, some of the four freedoms that President Roosevelt was talking about.
That's absolutely true. And it is one of the great kind of tragedies of the post-war world that we turned away from anti-colonialism and put such a great emphasis on anti-communism. Because of kind of this ideological blinders we put on, we got ourselves into struggles against countries like Vietnam, which were really basically looking for fighting a war of national liberation, and were not part of a global communist conspiracy as we thought at the time. Ho Chi Minh certainly was a communist. But, you know, he had embraced the United States and was our ally in the Second World War fighting the Japanese, and he assumed that we would support his desire to drive the French or keep the French out of Vietnam in the immediate post-war world. The other thing that Roosevelt did, of course, is right from his first inaugural was, in terms of foreign policy, he said that the United States would pursue the policy of the good neighbor.
Yes.
Again, this is not the phrase an American century with an American-led economic system or American-led values. This was the idea that we will we're going to be a good neighbor in Latin America. And this was enormously successful. And economically, the ties between the United States and Latin America flourished under Roosevelt's tenure.
Hmm.
Our relations with most Latin American countries were quite strong as a consequence of that policy. So again, it was a policy that was based on the idea of mutual respect and recognition that there were different cultures and different values that we had to familiarize ourselves with. And again, this is not to say that power wasn't an important part of this equation.
Uh-huh.
Roosevelt
uh-huh.
understood the need for power and particularly for American power in the world. But, you know, he fundamentally believed and understood that military power on its own was not enough, that that in order to counter the kind of extreme ideologies that we faced in the 30s that led to the disaster of the 1940s, we had to attack these problems of economic deprivation and so forth. He said famously in 1944, essentially that we've learned some hard lessons. One of which is that people who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff with which dictatorships are made. And he absolutely insisted that out of the war had to come a world that was where access to food and where access to raw materials and where people's ability to shape their destiny by themselves was greatly enhanced. And I think he firmly believed that.
Yeah, and it seemed like JFK tried to continue that somewhat with his Alliance for Progress. And back in 1977, I was in Peru in a little village that probably wasn't a bank within 100 miles of there. And we went into somebody's house that was a little one-room hut. And there on the wall was a velvet painting of JFK. Why? Because he respected them. He was continuing the good neighbor policy and respecting people. But certainly JFK was not weak on the military. No question about that. As FDR was, built up the strongest military in the world that finally crushed Nazism and Japanese imperialism as well. So I wonder, David, if we can do both, be both the number one military superpower and also implement programs like the Alliance for Progress, like the Good Neighbor Policy. Is it possible to do both, or wouldn't that be too costly?
Or the Peace Corps is another great example
of
a program that was launched during the Kennedy years. Well, I don't think we really have a choice. Unfortunately, we are faced with a serious problem, as you can see by what's going on today in the Middle East. And I think the evidence to say that our policy, that the militarization of American policy has not really provided us with the admiration and respect that we would want in the world can be seen today in the Middle East and the reaction, for example, of countries like Libya and Egypt and so forth, where even though the United States had come down in favor of the Arab Spring, we just don't command the kind of respect that one would think and hope for in this emerging new world that is coming in the Middle East. And we are seen as imperialistic, unfortunately, and we're seen as militaristic because American power is not American aid, it's not American foreign aid, it's American power that people see around the world. And people do not want to be dictated to, even if we insist that we're trying to do this to help them. And the reactions of the countries that we've been in Afghanistan and so forth, I think drives home the point that the militarization of our foreign policy has some really serious drawbacks, and we really need to think about how we present ourselves to the world. And I think President Obama did some work to reach out to the Arab community, for example, in his famous speech in Cairo and so forth. He also inherited these two wars, which, as a responsible president and commander-in-chief, he has to figure out a way to de-escalate and withdraw us from, which is not easy.
Yeah.
So in a way, he's inherited the situation that he has at hand. He hasn't had a free hand completely. He wants to close Guantanamo, but the U.S. Congress is preventing him from doing so, which I think is outrageous. I think nothing would speak to the American confidence in the rule of law more than bringing back these terrorists to lower Manhattan and putting them in court, in the U.S. court, and trying them in our criminal justice system. This whole idea that these are prisoners of war, that these are, they're in this warfare against this ideology, I think, you know, it really has some serious drawbacks. We have to stand for the rule of law. We have to stand for things like access to education, access to proper nutrition and avoidance of poverty. Just this idea that we are the best and that people should fall into line with us is really not going to get us where we need to go.
Yeah, there seems to be like two constituencies that any president has to deal with. There's the worldwide constituency that we're talking about, and then there's the constituency that votes. And, you know, on the second one, a lot of people, I think, now here in America don't have the historical understanding of what works and what doesn't work and want America to be tough. I think there are probably a lot of Americans who felt that when Romney kind of insulted our greatest traditional ally, England, the Prime Minister of England, that I imagine people actually like that. America standing tough for ourselves, not being pushed around. There's a recent quote from Mitt Romney who said, quote, "This is a time for a president who will shape events in the Middle East, not just be merciful or be at the mercy of events." He's facing that on one hand, and on the other hand, there's the more complicated reality. And I would think, you know, the eye on the prize must be on building real American security, protecting our families from more 9/11s, for example. Britain, when they had a terrorist attack on their subways a few years ago, they, it seems to me, pursued it in the courts in a legal fashion. They did not declare war, but they prosecuted these criminals. And it would appear that there's a lot of evidence that by the U.S. Treating the terrorist planners as warriors, we are elevating them. It's been said that many of our policies are creating more terrorists and that we fell exactly into Osama bin Laden's hands by giving him so much political power. I wonder how, you know, if we keep our eye on the prize of more American security, protecting us from more attacks, how has, if you look in the last 10 years in Afghanistan and specifically in Pakistan, how has our reliance on military solutions served us in terms of, protecting America? It's so difficult to look at that as well as, you know, trying to deal with the Americans who want to look tough and love being the imperial power. What do you think, David?
Well, I think you're right. The British refuse absolutely to identify the IRA, for example, as POWs. The IRA wanted military status. When an IRA terrorist was arrested, you know, they wanted to be treated as if they were military personnel. The British absolutely refused to do that. They were using their military force in trying to quell violence in Northern Ireland. And so the military was involved, but they refused rhetorically to go down that road, and they did lead with their criminal justice system. As a matter of fact, it was the criminal justice system and good police work which uncovered the bombing plot of the Stirling aircraft back in, I think it was 2005 or 6 or 7, I can't remember, but the case of the liquids being used to blow up aircraft, that was police work that discovered that, and they did prosecute the July bomber, July 7th bombers in the criminal justice system, because they're leading with the rule of law. And I think we haven't done as good a job on that front. I also think that, again, from the Middle Eastern perspective today, it's a little bit like the kind of situation you had in Latin America prior to Roosevelt's presidency. We were seen as the imperialists. We were seen as the interventionists. We were seen as the country that would send in troops at a moment's notice again and again and again.
Right.
The announcement that we were going to follow the policy of a good neighbor and we were no longer going to intervene militarily in Latin America was enormously successful. And it was followed up by trade agreements pursued by Cordell Hull and other policies that were mutually beneficial to both sides of that equation. And again, I think that the Middle East is a similar situation. They view us as imperialists, you know, instigating a new neighbor policy, good neighbor policy, where we make it clear that we're on the side of the people and that we're trying to fashion solutions to their problems that will respect their values and not necessarily be dictated from our standpoint, would get us much further than simply, you know, sending in aircraft carriers and the Marines.
Well, it is very complicated, it appears, in specifically in Egypt right now, and Obama's apparent sympathy for the protesters and his discussion with then-President Mubarak infuriated our traditional allies in the rather conservative, dictatorial, oil-rich Gulf states. I wonder, you know, how difficult a position it is for the president to both improve America's longstanding image, as you say, as a very violent imperialist power that ignores the will of the local population, and still maintain our traditional ties for our own security and cheap oil. Let's face it, that's something that people want. I wonder, you know, taking Roosevelt's idea of bringing freedom from want, using that as a foreign policy, I wonder, it's a very difficult situation for now, specifically in Egypt. And there's Saudi Arabia, which has been a longstanding ally, which has supplied a lot of oil. Would it be wise of the president to support, openly support, say, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood, and to support an uprising in Saudi Arabia? Sounds like that could be a little bit dangerous as well.
It would be dangerous, and that's what I'm saying. The world is a very complex one.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not unlike the same sorts of challenges that President Roosevelt faced. He had to ally the United States with the Soviet Union and in the struggle against Adolf Hitler. And, of course, he was talking about a war that would ultimately result in personal liberties and freedom from want and freedom from fear and so forth. And these were issues, of course, that were difficult to reconcile in the Second World War as they are today. But my point is that I think, you know, in terms of the rhetoric and the force of American foreign policy, Roosevelt was very committed internationalist. He was absolutely determined that we create the United Nations organization, which came out of the wartime alliance called the United Nations. He wanted to commit the American people to a level of international engagement that would, and he wanted to create a forum like the UN where smaller countries would feel they had the same respect and dignity as the larger countries. He did set up the Security Council with its five permanent members. He understood that there needed to be the exercise of power in the world. That was a great failing of the League of Nations, which couldn't respond to an international crisis. And he knew it wouldn't be easy, but if you had the British and the French and the Russians and the Chinese and the Americans sitting down trying to avoid war, the chances of a new catastrophic war on the scale of World War II were greatly reduced. So, you know, there was a myriad of responses to the world that he faced, and I think President Obama is trying to do much the same thing. He's very specifically going after the leadership of al-Qaeda. He's trying to disengage the United States in a responsible fashion from Afghanistan. He's pursuing policies around the world that are much more realistically based. He's more of a realist, certainly, than many of his predecessors. He's also, though, opened up the idea of dialogue and returned to this concept that we started the program with, that the United States really has to think about building a century of the common man, and what can we do to help people around the world empower themselves to make sure that they have basic economic security, instead of simply arriving and supporting existing military institutions and structures. You know, one of the other issues that we haven't touched upon is the issue of foreign aid, and of course, most Americans have a very distorted view of foreign aid. They think we give a huge amount of foreign aid. Actually, per capita, we're not that high in the world. And the percentage of foreign aid in the U.S. budget is less than 1%. It's a very small amount. The other thing that needs to be understood is a good deal of our foreign aid is military aid. it's called foreign aid, but in fact it's support for the military. And again, this distorts the situation. If you're in Egypt and you're hungry and out of a job, and you see tremendous millions, multiple millions and billions of dollars being poured into the Egyptian military, which has become a kind of Egyptian version of the military-industrial complex, have gone way beyond a simple military organization. They're into industry and so forth. That was the elite that was being supported by this military relationship with the United States. And of course, we had gained from that alliance in the sense that they had signed the Camp David peace accords and had adhered to our desire to maintain peace with Israel. So there were definitely beneficial aspects of that relationship. But again, it deprived the average Egyptian with much hope for his or her future. And eventually that system essentially exploded. And in order to fundamentally change Egyptian society, they needed to get rid of the grip of this military-industrial complex, both on their society but also on their economy. So again, you know, from an Egyptian perspective on the street, the United States' support for Israel is heavily militarized. You know, instead of building schools and providing access to education and trying to lift people out of poverty directly, we tend to, again, support these existing security structures. What are we doing in Afghanistan? We're putting all our emphasis on the building of an Afghan military.
Right.
There's this tendency to push for military. Nobody talks about Costa Rica making the decision in 1948 that maybe a military is a bad idea. And they got rid of it, and they are now the most progressive and democratic country in Central America. They have a police force. Everybody needs a police force. But they decided, you know what, we don't really need a military. We have this tendency to want to build up military institutions and think about American security as a military matter, when in fact it is so much more complex and so much more involving issues like poverty and like economic opportunity and security and access to education than simply, you know, putting boots on the ground.
Interesting. I mean, the people of Egypt know you can't eat missiles, you can't eat bullets, and people are hungry there. It's a difficult situation. You've talked just a couple of times, mentioned somebody who's not very well known, Henry A. Wallace, who was vice president and then I believe became Secretary of Agriculture and Secretary of Commerce. And Henry Wallace, who spoke about his vision of a century of the common man. And he ran for president on the Progressive Party in 1948. I'm proud to say my dad voted for him. He lost largely, I'm guessing, because he opposed the intensification, the ratcheting up of the Cold War with the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower later recognized. It seems that the weapons contractors in the United States probably got in his way. They, in turn, have done exceedingly well ever since the 1940s, and there's still this tremendously powerful military-industrial complex. I wonder if, in retrospect, were both parties, both the Soviets and the United States, seriously drained their treasuries in the Cold War, might Wallace's approach have worked then? And what about now? Is there applicability to the idea of a century of the common man, everybody's duty to sacrifice a bit for the general welfare? It wasn't popular back in 1948. Do you think such an approach might actually lead to more peace and security for Americans, or is it a little bit naive?
No, I don't think it's naive. I think that Wallace was absolutely right. You know, first of all, with respect to the Cold War, were there tensions with Russia? Yes. Were there, was the Soviet Union somewhat of a paranoid power? Yes. Are there tensions with China today? Yes. Are we able to live with China today? Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Is China communist? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Cold War played out in a way that trillions of dollars were spent on expansion of both countries' military. Certainly the Soviet Union, the citizens of Russia, suffered much more under that system than we did, because they were denied a great deal of what we would consider basic attributes of normal everyday life because of that. They didn't develop their private economy to the extent that they probably would have if they hadn't spent all this money on the military. So again, this is not to say that the Russians and that Soviet communism didn't present some kind of a threat to us. But, you know, again, we now know in retrospect, and we now know since the opening of the Soviet archives, that Stalin was perfectly intent on adhering to his agreements after the war, that it really is only after 47 that he really begins to kind of start mucking about in Europe in a more aggressive way. He obviously wanted to dominate Poland and the Baltic states and parts of Eastern Europe that the Soviet Union was occupying. That was a policy he made clear from day one, which was, of course, unfortunate. There was very little the United States, unfortunately, could do about that, or Britain could do about that, because, of course, he had millions of troops on the ground, and we couldn't start World War III to do this, so that was a difficult situation. But Wallace recognized that, you know, part of what was happening was a kind of rigidity and a kind of rhetorical approach towards the Russians that they were feeling threatened, and they were responding to. And, you know, he suggested an alternative. We had been allies during the war. We had worked cooperatively during the war. And he saw no reason that we couldn't continue that policy of cooperation. Doesn't mean you trust them completely, but that cooperation was better than this sort of confrontation. And I think that, you know, particularly now that we can look at the documents, there is much about the Cold War that was tragically unnecessary. And Vietnam would be another good example of that. The other issue in terms of the question of the century of the common man goes back to what we've been talking about all along, which is, you know, Roosevelt, I can't quote him exactly, but he made the comment to, you know, someone said, well, why should an American person care about what goes on in Java? And he said, well, you know, in this world, the world is a much smaller place. And insecurity in other parts of the world ultimately leads to insecurity in our part of the world. And, I mean, the example of the 30s and the Second World War was blatantly obvious to that generation. You know, the fact that the Japanese didn't have access to raw materials they needed, very little raw materials in Japan, and they needed access to the Asian mainland, other parts of Southeast Asia to get those. And, of course, under the colonial system, they couldn't get access, and ultimately their recourse was to military action. So it was a very real thing. So providing a world that where, you know, you did away with colonialism and where you worked hard to rid the world of this problem of freedom from want was very much a security issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so Wallace had been involved in Central America and other parts of the world where he had worked with local farmers and knew that the sort of innate abilities of people around the world to work to help themselves, he saw that as a much more lasting sort of policy than simply coming in and saying, you know, you need to grow this cash crop and sell it on the world market but you know, looking at local agriculture and taking a much more localized approach to these kinds of problems. And of course it takes longer and it can be frustrating, but I think in the long run he actually was right.
It can build more security if people are less angry when they have something to eat, when there is, as we started out with, freedom from want, certainly that can pay off. I think it's somewhat amusing that the right-wing blogosphere seems to have latched onto anti-colonialist as a new insult. I think that's fascinating. And the idea that the U.S. can show leadership in helping people just to eat, to have freedom from want, pays off for us. It's not naive. It's not isolationist. I mean, you know, if we cut back on our military adventures, that doesn't automatically make us into isolationists. Now, maybe some people on the right feel that these days. Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt were really pushing hard for a strong United Nations. Eleanor famously pushed for and won a Declaration of Human Rights at the United Nations. That was after the war. FDR's speech calling for the Four Freedoms and the founding of the UN came from the same base. And I find it fascinating that many these days in the United States have absolute disdain for the United Nations. It's seen as a place for small countries to bash the U.S. It used to be just the John Birch Society that would, you know, be against the U.N. But nowadays, it seems like the far right has really taken over the formerly conservative Republican Party. I wonder what role, you know FDR pretty well, what role would he see today for the United Nations? Is it still a viable place? Is it something that the United States could and should rely on and incorporate more in foreign policy? I mean, a lot of people are against the UN because they say, oh, it's world government taking over and that we're surrendering our power to them. What do you think FDR would say to all that?
Well, he would completely reject that argument. First of all, the United Nations was an institution that was built largely through American leadership. We were the ones who essentially led the way towards the creation of the UN, and it had massive universal support both among the American public and around the world. And Roosevelt, of course, was very careful to involve senior Republican leadership in the creation of the United Nations. He also launched things like the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration in 1943. That was a wartime agency that went out to feed people around the world and was eventually supplanted in after the war by the Marshall Plan.
Mm-hmm.
The United Nations was a critical institution as far as Roosevelt was concerned, and it has played a crucial role in maintaining the peace and in raising the standard of living and establishing health standards and universal standards for a whole host of issues since its founding in 1945. And interestingly enough, you know, in spite of the criticism from the right, all American presidents have used the UN. It's a very useful tool. It doesn't represent a world government. It is only as powerful as the nations in it. It requires the cooperation of the member countries to be able to act to do anything. So there is no UN army that's out there taking over the world. This is all dependent on the member countries contributing resources and, in some cases, troops and so forth to make it function. But it has played an absolutely critical role. And one of the I can't remember the statistics exactly, but one of the more interesting things is that one president who used it a great deal, in fact, in his second term, was George W. Bush, who was very much one of the critics of the UN. And of course, the president who probably in the recent years elevated the UN higher than anyone else was George H.W. Bush.
Hmm.
Think about this for a moment. In leading the first Gulf War, had the Syrian army and the Egyptians fighting alongside of Americans in invading Iraq in 1991.
Yeah.
And that was a completely UN-led operation. He absolutely followed the dictates of a kind of an international FDR Rooseveltian approach to that. And made it quite clear what America's policy was, but built a consensus, built a international coalition that was formulated within the United Nations itself, and it was enormously successful. And I once was talking to Brett Scowcroft, Bush's security advisor, about this, and saying that, you know, I often point to this to my students to show an example of a U.S.-led effort that was basically executed within the U.N., and Mr. Scowcroft told me that when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, the first thing the president said to him was, call the UN and call NATO.
Wow.
And that it was a UN and a multilateral effort from day one. Unfortunately, what we've seen in recent years is a kind of we-know-best return to unilateralism. It's a new form of isolationism, if you will, that we want to be aggressive in the world, but we want to do it on our terms. And it's sort of the coalition of the willing concept, and I think this is really a new form in many ways of isolationism. It's a approach to foreign policy that is very much unilaterally based. That the United States knows best, and we're going to do this. And if you want to come along with us, that's fine. And this is the antithesis of what Roosevelt tried to do. Again, he understood the need for American power, and he used American power. He is, after all, the creator of the atom bomb. More than 100,000 people were employed in the creation of that atomic power. So he completely understood the need for American power, and of course we used it in World War II. But again, the international cooperation was the key, including the Russian cooperation. And so yes. Roosevelt wasn't thinking, you know, 45 was the end. 45 for Roosevelt was the beginning.
Right.
And this is where Wallace, I think, was so frustrated with the response that the Truman administration had to the Soviet Union, that you know, partly because of circumstance, partly because of the suspicions of the Russians, partly because of Truman's inexperience, we kind of fell into this rhetorical stance that eventually led to the rise of these very heightened tensions, which led to the Cold War, and I'm the first to admit that both sides have a big responsibility in this.
Yeah.
But from the Roosevelt perspective, international cooperation was the key. And, of course, he assumed that America would be a leading figure, if not the leading figure, in that international cooperation. But to do that, you had to do other things. You had to stress freedom from want and freedom from fear. You had to stand for the kinds of values that people around the world could support. And you couldn't be a chauvinist. You couldn't say the American way is the only way. And that was a critical component. You know, much of what happens in the post-war world was inspired by Franklin Roosevelt. The anti-colonialism, the throwing off of this European empires that we see in the 50s and 60s. A lot of this was people wanted to live in the kind of world that Roosevelt articulated.
Mm.
And it had a huge impact.
I believe people still do. Again, we're talking with David Wilner, a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. And, you know, we've spent trillions of dollars. The Soviets drained their treasury as well. The developing countries have not really made out all that well, although now throughout South America, they're becoming more independent and taking action on their own. And I think there's a lot of concern among Americans that despite all these trillions we've spent and the untold lives and limbs lost, we seem to become somewhat of a bystander in foreign affairs, specifically in Northern Africa, the Middle East, Asia, South and Central America. Briefly, could this, what Roosevelt talked about, bringing freedom from want back, could this be helpful in making us less of a bystander and more of a participant somehow? Is it possible, or is this a pipe dream?
I don't think it's a pipe dream. Again, I think it's absolutely critical. I mean, if you look, for example, at religious extremism in some of the organizations that we are uncomfortable with, like Hamas and the Palestinian occupied territories in Gaza and so forth, they've been providing education, schools, healthcare, things that people need that are in desperate straits. And simply building up, for example, the Egyptian military, really in the long run, is not something that the Egyptian people could that would resonate with the Egyptian people. So when they finally were able to overthrow this regime, of course, they welcome our support. They welcome President Obama's endorsement of this. But they don't see the United States as sort of the beacon that they should aspire to. They feel that they have to do this on their own. We have become something of a bystander because for most of the world, what they see when they think of the United States is American military power. And I think we need to really rethink. Do we need, we're talking about a gang of thugs here that are horrible and we need to pursue them vigorously. But, is this really getting us where we need to go in the world? Are we becoming irrelevant with our aircraft carriers and our massive military industrial complex? Wouldn't we be better off to try to get on the ground and do real economic development that's organically based and that provides people with education and economic security, the kinds of things that families need on a day-to-day basis. I think that would so much better serve us in the long run than simply saying, we've got to smoke these people out.
Yeah, and crush them. Use their overwhelming power to crush them. David Wilner, wonderful to talk to you. If people are interested in looking at the Roosevelt Institute, what they're up to, what website can you point them to?
Well, we have RooseveltInstitute.org is the main website for the Institute. And if you're interested in reading editorial pieces on these kinds of questions, there's we have a website that's linked to that called The Next New Deal, which you can find a number of articles written about these kinds of questions.
David Woolner, thank you so much. Fascinating perspective. It's good to look at history, what's possible. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I always love to hear from you, Bert, at bertcohen.com. Thank you.
All pirates, yes, they rob I, sold out to the merchant ships, just moments after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Imagine all the people living for today. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. Only ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand beside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. No religion.